pledge their utter devotion to their leader. Through many adversities, they are known to go unwavering in their belief. Many have been disowned by their families, but they gather together in strength. They have been physically beaten. They've persevered. They have been tortured. They keep recruiting. Governments have come against them, and those governments have been overthrown from within. They have been rounded up and killed. Their numbers keep growing. What is driving them? Why do they believe? Why are people compelled to join them? What will they do next?
Come on. Good evening. Right now, we want to welcome everyone joining from all our other campuses and streaming from around the world. And we're here together for a common purpose. We're here to discuss the greatest controversy in the history of man. Some controversies that pass with time. By next week's tabloids, what is considered a controversy today will be forgotten by next week. And yet what we're talking about tonight is a controversy that has spanned eras, societies, continents, and it shows no sign of dying out anytime soon. That word controversy means a disagreement. But not just any disagreement, it means a disagreement that is typically prolonged, public, and heated in its nature. The kind of disagreement that gets your blood pressure to rise. The kind of disagreement that gets you up out of your seat. The kind of disagreement that separates close friendships and brings you in contact and into relationship with other people you never thought you would have had anything to relate with them on. But because you both see this controversy the same way, suddenly you are together. It's a controversy that, like I said, has spanned continents. Right now, if you're to turn on the news, you'll see on almost a weekly basis, organizations such as ISIS have denounced it. Chinese government has labeled it public enemy number one to their internal security. This controversy ignited Poland's emancipation from the Soviet bloc in 1989. Dr. Martin Luther King himself consulted with this man at the center of the controversy and his teachings on a regular basis as he altered the very fabric of American society. Entire nations have been created as a result of this conflict. I'm talking about United Nations Resolution 181 and the creation of the modern-day state of Israel. Yeah, that was influenced by this controversy. You go back a little bit further, 1776, and the creation of the United States of America and the founding fathers who came together and spoke this nation into being. They, too, were profoundly influenced by this movement that started in the Middle East. The printing press itself with movable type, created in 1455, was not just created to reproduce comics or periodicals on the newsstand. It was created with the specific purpose of perpetuating this man's propaganda, this man's controversy. And because of that printing process, this man's teachings have become the most widely distributed source of media in the history of mankind. Time itself is measured since the year 525 when European leaders came together by before and after this controversy was birthed. Time itself, how we measure time, the human experience around the world, throughout the epochs and eras of history, it all goes back to before and after this one single controversy took place. At the center of all of this is not money. At the center of all of this is not a piece of land. At the center of this controversy is one man. Over the years, he's been called many things, many names, some honoring him, some attempting to dishonor him. But his original founders called him Yeshua HaMashiach, and his movement was birthed in one of the most backward corners of the Roman Empire. We know he spread his ideals for just 3 short years. Both believers and disbelievers both agree on the events leading up to his execution. And at this moment, all indicators say that following his death, this movement should have been destroyed, should have caved on itself, it should have imploded, it should have been buried in the sands of time and history. And yet we're discussing this controversy tonight because what we've seen is the exact opposite. Controversy that no matter what has been thrown at it, it has overcome it again and again and again. You see, the problem with controversy is that it can be difficult to understand fact from fiction. Anyone who's been in a relationship for longer than 5 minutes and had a bit of a controversy in your own relationship knows what I'm talking about right there. You can have one story, two people, and there's actually three sides to the story. One side, the other side, and the truth somewhere in between. See, controversy gets complicated. It can be hard to understand. And so what we do this evening is we're going to peel back the layers of public debate, the layers of history, and the layers of bias surrounding this Middle Eastern man in hopes of getting to the bottom of the controversy of all controversies. And in hopes of trying to land what we don't know, let us proceed from this moment forward with what we do know. The first thing we know is that this man at the core of this controversy was born an enemy of the state. He was born an enemy of the state. Anyone who studied history for any length of time has likely heard of a man named Josephus Flavius. What many people don't know is that was not this historian's birth name. He was actually born Yosef ben Matityahu, and he was a Jewish general in the first Roman Jewish War. And in the year AD 67, he was commanding Jewish forces at the siege of Jotapata in the north of what is now modern-day Israel. He had 42,000 combatants and civilians under his care, and Roman forces under the control of Vespasian laid a lengthy siege at the bottom of this fortress. And when it was all said and done, 40,000 of Josephus's followers were killed. Men, women, children, soldiers, civilians, and many who were just caught up in the midst of the conflict. 1,200 of his followers ended up actually being enslaved. 800 of them, records say, to this day, they never know what happened to them. The Romans were so impressed with the commanding presence of this man who later became Josephus that he was given honorary Roman citizenship and given the right to travel throughout the Roman Empire and to make an account of what was happening in those lands during that time. And it was in those days that he quickly began to hear about this man and his movement and his followers showing up all across the Roman Empire. And one person that Josephus regularly talks about was a commander in the area of Israel whose name was Herod. One thing he makes very clear about Herod is Herod was a violent, aggressive leader. He ruled his region of the Roman Empire with an insecure iron fist. He had many sons, and records show that at one moment, he actually heard his own sons talking about what would happen when this leader passed away. He was so insecure in his reign and so didn't like the idea of other people thinking of themselves being rulers that on the spot, he ordered the execution of two of his boys. When his own wife came to him and said that what he did was not a good thing, he had her head literally removed. What we know about Herod is that he was a bloodthirsty leader who often used violence as a means of psychological warfare to keep people under his control. What does this have to do with the controversy? Well, the man at the center of this controversy was born in a city called Bethlehem in Judea. And when he was born, there was a series of unique events around his birth that caused people in his region, which happened to be the same area that Herod reigned, to say that this man would one day grow up to be king. And so immediately Herod claimed that this individual was an enemy of the state and said all young boys ages 2 or less in the area of Bethlehem were to be killed without any investigation simply because they were male in the area where there was a claim that someone would take his throne. Now to put this in a modern day context, it honestly makes the worldwide manhunt of Osama bin Laden look like a Boy Scout expedition. I mean, let's be honest for a moment. Most of us here remember who this man is, the mastermind between the attacks on New York City World Trade Center towers on September 11th, 2001. The very same man who also masterminded the only successful attack on the Pentagon in the history of the United States. This very same man went into hiding immediately after having waged war with our nation, and an international coalition of forces was sent to find him. Now again, to put this in context, how Herod treated the man at the center of this controversy would be as if our own armed forces showed up in the nation of Afghanistan and said overnight, "We know the man behind these actions is 44 years old, and so any man in this nation between the ages of 40 and 45, we're gonna kill you. We're not gonna ask you who you are. We're not gonna ask you what you do. We're not gonna worry if you have kids. We're not gonna worry what your job is. We're not gonna ask you about your background. It doesn't matter what your role is in the government or the society of this nation. We're going to take you out." Why? Because you fit in that age group. Why? Because we want one person in your midst dead. That is what Herod did to this man at the center of the movement days after his birth. The simple act of birth was controversial for this man. Following his birth, for understandable reasons, his family went black, off the grid, under the radar. They stayed out of sight, out of mind, for completely understandable reasons. And it would not be until his 30th birthday that we would have any real substantial records of his whereabouts or what he did with his time. The second thing we know about this man is that his known associates are criminals. His known associates are criminals. And I quote, "I did not come for the pure and the upstanding, but I came to call the notorious." The man at the center of this controversy did not come looking for perfect people. He did not come looking for people who seemed to have it all together. He did not come looking for those that society seemed to lift on a pedestal. There were claims in court, both local and federal, about this man's grievances against the laws of the land. Eyewitnesses testify that at one moment he was actually seen speaking with a man condemned to die, moments away from death. And what he said to the man was, "Though society does not accept you, I accept you." This man was different. People had trouble understanding him because he treats people differently. Prince or pauper, time and again, the record of his actions shows this man has no favorites. He simply seems to enjoy the opportunity to live life alongside others, even those that society rejects. On multiple occasions, he was seen in physical contact with people who had diseases that were incurable, highly contagious, and causing them to be ostracized by society. This man did not care. He sat with them. He talked with them. He made them feel like human beings, even though the entire world around them felt like they were not worth the dirt on the bottom of their shoes. He spent time with crooked politicians, extortionists, and prostitutes, and led all to believe that they were valuable people. His agenda is unlike any other. He seems to be building whatever it is that he's building, using those that society rejects just as readily as those that society accepts. Whether you are accepted or rejected by the people in your world, this man at the center of this controversy says that there is room for you. The third thing we know about this man is that he is a man of war. And again, I quote him as saying, "Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to this earth. I did not come to bring peace, but I bring a sword." I didn't come to bring peace. I didn't come to leave things the way they are. I didn't come to just look at the situation and think that I'm powerless to do anything about it. He said, "I have come to war with the establishment and to take the things that are and to carry them into what could be." You could hear these words of warfare, words of the removal, the extraction of peace. And we could understandably ask, what room is there for a worldview such as this in the 21st century, when we champion the goodness of humanity, and yet there's more wars across the globe than ever before? When we teach our children that man is inherently good, and yet no longer are we comfortable going to bed with our doors unlocked at night. We try to tell ourselves that we care for our brother. And yet as we go through life, our fists grow tighter and tighter. And less goes out to those around us. What room is there for talk of war in the 21st century? I'd like to submit for your consideration this evening as we discuss the controversy that not all wars are the same. There are wars that are unjust, but there are also wars that are just. Consider the days of 1940 to 1945 when the world was on fire with the flames of World War. Hitler was charging across the continent of Europe, the north of Africa, and beginning to make his way towards the Middle East and doing unspeakable evils to people along the way. Would it have been more evil to wage war against that sort of a force, or would it have been a greater evil to know about it and do nothing? A simple examination of that one chapter of history teaches us sometime more evil than doing something is to simply do nothing. This man decided that rather than leave the world the way it was, something had to be done. One of his most prominent followers in the 20th century, a man named C.S. Lewis, said, "Enemy occupied territory, that is what this world is." His story is the story of how the rightful king has landed, and he is calling us to take part in a great campaign. No question this man came for war, but the question is, what are the tools of his warfare? He has said, "Love your leader with all of your heart and with all of your being." This is the greatest rule. And the second rule is like it: love your neighbor as yourself. He goes on to say, love your enemy. Do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Love your enemies and pray for those who harm you, that you may be sons of your Father. This man waged a war, but it is a war that does not extend in advance on the end of a sword. It is a war that is propelled by a passion and a furious love for the freedom and the emancipation of mankind. Another thing we know about this man tonight is that he operates outside the law. He operates outside the law. And we can look at that and say, big deal. Every day I open up my newspaper and there's people operating outside the law. I do not speak of tax codes. I don't speak of speed limits. And I'm certainly not speaking of those demonic things we call homeowners associations. And everybody said, yeah. All right. We're speaking of something much deeper. We're speaking of a law far greater than that. The hubris of this individual seems almost incomprehensible because he claims to be stronger than the grave. Alexander the Great had a kingdom that changed the world, changed history, changed humanity. And yet when he died, his kingdom followed him into the grave. Napoleon, when speaking of himself, painted pictures of being deity in the form of human flesh. And yet all he managed to do was plunge the world into greater uncertainty. And with his passing, so did his movement. Pol Pot, brutal dictatorial leader that history is doing everything it can to forget, because though he thought he would stand the test of time, as soon as he was gone, the people voted and said, we want nothing to do with this man. Wow. Saddam Hussein, another man who had an inflated view of self, and he hung on the gallows. And today, the place that was once his kingdom is now reeling, trying to figure out, what will we make of ourselves? Time and again, history shows us men who tried to claim that they were gods and they would withstand the test of the grave, and none of them have been able to do it. Interestingly enough, this man has made that claim himself. And no one disputes this man lives. No one disputes this man taught for 3 years on this earth. No one disputes that he was tortured before his moment of death. No one disputes that Roman soldiers crucified him on a hill outside of Jerusalem. Yet there is disagreement on whether or not he truly operated outside the law of death. There are many theories trying to explain away whether he overcame the grave or not. We have time tonight for two of those. The first theory I wish to speak of is the swoon theory. This theory simply states that this man, while hanging on the cross, came to the point of death, but did not actually die. And that when Roman soldiers looked at him, they mistakenly pronounced him dead, and so took him down from the cross, laid him in a tomb. And that given a little bit of rest and relaxation, he was able to resuscitate himself and walk out of the grave a new man. There are a few problems with this theory. Number one, Roman soldiers faced the punishment of death if they incorrectly pronounced a person dead. They made sure that the criminal was dead. Better a dead criminal than a dead soldier in the minds of the soldiers. Another problem with this is that doctors have looked at eyewitness accounts of this man's passing, and they have found symptoms in the recounting of his moments leading up to the cross of hypovolemic shock. This is not the shock you get when one of your young people in your house pops up around the corner and surprises you. There's only one major way to enter into hypovolemic shock. It is the catastrophic loss of blood. So much blood loss that your blood pressure goes low enough to where your heart no longer is able to pump enough blood throughout your body. We also see signs that when the Roman soldier stabbed a spear into his chest and blood and water came out, that he had what is called a pericardial effusion. And this is when water is trapped around the heart. It constricts the heart's ability to beat, and it is a fatal occurrence. As well, there are other testaments of what happened to this man while hanging on a cross that seem to be symptomatic with the contraction of tetanus during the crucifixion process. Simply being left in a grave, unattended, in darkness, no food, no water for a number of days is not the doctor's prescription for dealing with any one of those physical maladies. In fact, to address those issues in the manner in which the swoon theory suggests only has one possible outcome, and that outcome is death. Furthermore, if this man couldn't even support his own weight on the cross, how could he, even if feeling better, on his own, roll a stone out of the way of a tomb weighing in excess of a ton? Simply could not be done. You can believe the swoon theory if you like, but it sounds to me like you're trying harder to not believe than you are to actually believe. Another theory out there is what's called the theft theory, and it claims that this man's followers came in under the cover of darkness, Zero Dark 30 style, and instead of killing someone, actually took his body out and tried to make him seem alive. The problem with this theory is that it assumes a level of courage among his followers that all accounts, even the accounts of his own followers, say they did not have. History tells us all of these men left their leader at the moment he needed them the most. Furthermore, this man's tomb was guarded at the request of religious leaders in the city of Jerusalem by crack members of the Roman legion stationed in Jerusalem. One, these men were afraid. Two, they were not trained in military warfare. And so entering in under the cover of darkness, it is again highly unlikely that they would have been brave enough or knowledgeable enough to stage a successful operation against well-trained soldiers and in the process take a body out of there with any sign of their having been there received the next day. Finally, we know that the opposers of this man and his controversy would never have even dreamed of taking his body themselves, because they would have run the risk of validating his claim to operate outside the law of life and death. The greatest evidence we have of whether or not this man rose from the grave or not is simply this: the actions of his followers following their moment standing by the grave. Of this leader's 12 core followers, only one died of natural causes. Andrew was crucified. Nathanael was skinned alive and crucified downward. James the Greater was stabbed through with swords. James the Lesser was thrown from a high peak. Those watching from the ground below, upon his landing, caved his skull in with stones that were close by. Jude was beat to death with a club. Matthew was burned, stoned, and then beheaded. Peter was in the process of being crucified when he said he was not worthy of being killed the same way his leader was. And so he requested to be crucified upside down. Philip also suffered the similar fate. Simon was sawn in half. In a day where we believe the works of ISIS are grisly, those actions pale in comparison to what was done to that man. Perhaps most interesting of all, a man named Thomas. Once called Doubting Thomas because he did not believe his leader rose from the grave. Thomas, at the moment of testing, did not recant his faith in his leader's claims of resurrecting from the grave, but instead was willing to endure being impaled with a number of spears. And when that did not kill him, the onlookers tied him to a post and lit his body on fire and watched him die a slow death. Countless others history did not deem worthy of recounting their names paid the same price. Their children sold into slavery. Some of them killed this week in Kenya. Others were fed to lions and other beasts in Roman Colosseums as a twisted form of entertainment. People do not endure such things for theories, lies, or old wives' tales. People do this for something that they believe to be the truth. He claimed to be a God. He said, I have come so that you may have life and you may have it to the full. He says this, he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one gets to God but through me. It's not through being good enough. It's not through being wise enough. It's not through being convincing enough. It is through faith in this leader alone. He went on to say, in an age of where people thought, in an age where people said man must find their God, he brought a message saying God is looking to find man. He said God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, and that whoever believes in him would not perish but have everlasting life. He spoke of a God who accepted less than he deserved so his creation could have more than it deserves. He was a servant in form, a man indeed. He took the likeness of humanity, humbling himself, obedient to death, a merciless death on a cross. It says he took on the flesh and became human, and he chose to live beside us. Ladies and gentlemen, this man I speak of is Jesus of Nazareth. He was born the enemy of a world enslaved to sin. He is the friend of convicts, people who are not right with their God. He is at war for the freedom of humanity. And tonight, he operates outside the laws of sin and death and calls you into his kingdom, calls you into his love. And right now, I close our conversation of the controversy with one conversation history tells us he had. Looking at his disciples, he said, who do they say the Son of Man is? They said, some say John the Baptist. Some say Elijah. Some say Isaiah. Some say Jeremiah or some other prophet. And he looked at them just as he looks at you tonight. And he said, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Right now, that is not a question to consider another day.
another time. It is a question to answer right now. It is a controversy of all controversies. It's inconceivable to people that God would take his one and only son, dress him in the flesh of man, send him into this world to be misunderstood, misspoken of, and abused for no other reason but that you might live free.